welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So next week, I mean, we are in Beltane-ish right now, we will explain, but next week I begin Way of the Trickster, a course through the Shift Network, May 8th, and then there's the United Astrology Congress in Chicago, May 24th to 28th. I'll be doing an all-day Trickster Council, and then June 8th through 14th, one of the most beautiful dancers I know, Benefşe, Embodied Prayer via Dedicated Beauty, will be leading a trip to Turkey, again, June 8th through 14th. I'll be providing astro-mytho news reports every day. So you can find out about all those things at coyotenetworknews.com. So here we are, team, navigating the underworld ghost river, and we are hosting mytho ally Michael Mead to proffer guiding at this turbulent, edgy time. But as trickster brother David Grimes, river guide, says, in turbulent rapids, there's always a silver tongue of calm. Find that. So let's find that silver tongue of calm and paddle together, team. And our goats may have gotten got, but they have returned even friskier than before they got. So now we have our goat in a boat with us. Hey. So it is true Beltane this whole week, and it will be exact on Cinco de Mayo. Beltane is one of the four cross-quarter holidays, honored and celebrated as much as equinoxes and solstices were, Halloween, Candlemas, Beltane, and Lammas. It was thought of that this exact mid-season, called one of the four gates of power, was where power, the quality and intelligence of the season, was especially eager to be invited in. And it was at this time last year that I last cahooted with Michael Mead. So we gather to avert greater disaster. We gather to consider to avert greater disaster. Welcome, right on animistic schedule, Michael Mead.
Thank you so much. Good to hear you, Caroline.
Pleasure. And again, your website is mosaicvoices.com and also
.org.
Living Myth. .org, excuse me.
Yeah.
Mosaicvoices.org, thank you. And also livingmyth.org. You are one of the most prolific people I know. I want to be like you when I grow up. That's really impressive. Been listening to so much. So, yes, so many places to go, but I want to sort of put forth on our work table that, you know, I love the word endogenous, and, you know, I love the phrase I've kind of coined, entheo-endogenous indigenuity. Endogenous means we have receptors for it, like for cannabis or DMT. But I think myth is endogenous, too, and you're one of the great bringers of myth alive again for all of us, and that we have our receptors going, yes, yes, what a good idea. So, there's many places we want to go, but I like saying that myths never end. They get put on pause, and we want to hit play. And one of the things, you know, I've been reading Why the World Doesn't End, Tales of Renewal and Times of Loss, really excellent bedtime reading. And this theme of exile and return, and, you know, I love the word ecstatic, which means to stand outside. It can be kind of another word for exile, right? We haven't just been exiled, we've been ecstatic, and now it's time to return to the court. Does that resonate with yourself?
Well, yeah, and this, I was thinking when you said exile, I right away thought of the idea. Anyone alive at this time who is not feeling some level of exile is not awake. And what I mean by that is the way the mainstream in particular, with this kind of amazing draining of the truth from conversation, that lack of truth is an exile to the soul, moment to moment. And so, in that sense, there can be a feeling of exile. But at the same time, being an outsider makes one more available to the ecstatic. And then I think you could also say, whatever makes us ecstatic eases the exile that happens, you know, in the center of culture.
Right.
So, yeah, and I think it's a dance between the exile and the ecstatic.
Yes, and maybe composting the whaley-whaley part, maybe, you know, but we do want to get to fear and dissent and these necessary things and slowing time down. But I like, you know, at what passes for the end of the Grail legend and the Arthurian legends, you know, all the spiritually hip people go away, right? Arthur goes to Avalon to you know, take Pilates classes with the priestesses, and Merlin goes off with the nymph into the fairy world, right? But because the origin of the experiment of the round table comprised of shining, radiant, equal individuals was to have spiritually cultivated people, you might say, with an inner life, you know, engaged in wise governance to, you know, to protect life. And then they all go away. And the legend, of course, is that Arthur didn't die. He's in Avalon, you know, awaiting the world's call at a time of great danger. And we go, now would be really good, right, to have the positive leadership return, right? So in that sense, you know, Ollie Ollie Income Free, maybe from exile. Well, I love a conversation with an ally, Carolyn Raffensperger, who we were saying, you know, when culture's in big trouble, it turns to its outsiders.
Yeah, she has a number of, Yeah, the outsider is in the position to receive the mythic inoculation, you could say. That which is missing can't enter through everything that's structured, even when the structure's falling apart. So it enters through the outsiders. And just thinking in terms of Arthurian legend and Beltane, giving it maybe more of an Irish turn, the idea there was when the round table broke up, all of those who had been at the table were told to go to where the forest looked darkest to them and there find a thread that they could pull back in order to remake the center one day.
Yes.
The exile becomes also the one who brings the context of the center back by pulling the threads of meaning one person at a time.
Right. And the example that Carolyn Raffensperger brought up, being an archaeologist before she was an environmental lawyer, in the 17th century in the Four Corners area of America, there was an outsider living in their midst, and who could speak all the different languages, including the colonial language of Spanish, and could predict the weather by acute observation. So he speaks to everyone because he's the only one who can, right? I just want to underline that outsider quality sometimes, right? And he says the weather will be such and such, it will be difficult for the Spanish to resupply. If you want to boot them out, now's the time. So they rose up, it's the great mid-17th century, you know, Pueblo uprising, and booted them out. But even cooler, 12 years later, one Jupiter story cycle later, they invite the Spanish back in, not as conquerors, but as collaborators on irrigation projects and stuff. And we go, so I like this resonating in everybody, going, oh, the outsider, you know, speaks many languages, can talk to everybody, might not want to, but give it a try, you know, and predict the weather. There's a lot of kinds of weather, right? And we can feel that coming. But does that amuse you or resonate with you, that historic story?
It's charming and intriguing. And it was making me think, the outsider perhaps, or I would at least say the outsider in me, feels that it's somewhat of a sacrifice to try to bring something all the way in to the middle, the main part of culture. And I think when I was younger, I didn't even want to try. It was like, more like, if I'm seeing this beautiful story, mythological imagery, and you want to come and look at it, fine, but I'm not bringing it to you, per se. And then, as I've gotten older, I've kind of come around to the idea, well, if it can be helpful, then I'm going to find a way to try to do that. And so that's, I don't know what that says about the outsider, but I think even the outside of the psyche wants to connect to the center sometimes. That may be part of that. Or, well, the way I'm thinking about it nowadays is the bodhisattva as outsider coming back. And that what we really need now, with everything gone upside down and turned sideways, is what they used to call the bodhisattva. And whatever enlightenment or wisdom a person might find really needs to be brought back and offered, at least in the middle of things, because of the, I guess I think of it as world upside down. and the number of people that are suffering in so many ways. And so I found myself thinking a lot about that idea of a bodhisattva. And not that everybody has to get enlightened, but whatever light anybody finds maybe is more needed now than ever.
Well, that's, you know, mythologically and calendrically brilliant, because right behind us just now on Sunday was the Buddha's full moon, the full moon, you know, sun in Taurus, incarnational sensuality, moon in Scorpio, the invisible spirit world. And it's mythologically when the Buddha was born and when he attains enlightenment with his back pressed against the Bodhi tree. Nobody gets enlightened without trees. There you go. And then we're heading into Beltane, again, this incarnational, sensual thing, you know, come on in, power, and dedicated acts of beauty invite power into the world. And then we're headed for May 15th, the new moon in Taurus, which is when Uranus, trickster, nature's evolutionary trickster genius, enters Taurus that day. And there's a lot of ways to play that. I'm pitching that it's, you know, a renaissance of democratic animism. Everything's alive in respect. The last time was the late 30s and 40s, and in Europe they had fascism, and in America the New Deal. So it can go a number of ways, and that's kind of where we're here to kind of pitch that thing. And having been, you know, the underworld's been kicking my butt lately in an interesting good way, and so people had always wanted me to watch the movie Pan's Labyrinth, and I sort of resisted, and I go, oh, and then I finally watched it on the plane coming back from a way deep dark medicine adventure, and I go, okay, the distilled essence of that movie is the absence of magic leads to fascism. I mean, that's really the thing. Have you seen that movie?
Oh, yeah. Tremendous. Yeah. But you said the absence of magic leads to?
Fascism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally makes sense. Because that's when the wonder is lost, and that's when the awe of existence is lost. And that's when you're going to get the most rigid and rejecting and, you know, dehumanizing energy. When, I mean, the human at center, at core, has to be in touch with that magic that is the breath of the world.
Right. And you know, everything real, everything mythological, everything symbolic, you know, and I love the fairy tale theme that you elaborate and give fresh voice to. And, you know, it's the youngest child who again pulls off the waters of life, you know, over and over again, a great resonant fairy tale. And I am the youngest, but I did just have a visit from an older sibling who in some, you know, we forgive everybody, give energy for change in the fairy tale. And she did come into my house, which looks a little magical, but she said just out of nowhere, she goes, I hate creation myths. And I'm worried, you know, that you're, you know, not rational. And I go, oh, well, yeah. And so as she was, and then complaints about many things, and I thought, I need to clean the fish tank before I go on this trip. Let me just vacuum up the fish poop at the bottom while she's talking. There you go, there you go. She got into the cab to leave. She yelled, I like rationalism. Anyway, I just thought that fit in with your mythic theme. And I go, okay, I don't take it personally. It's a fairy tale assignment, and everybody operates on many levels, but I thought that was intriguing. Yes, are you a youngest person? Or mythologically you are, but are you literally?
Yeah, I keep trying to get younger that way. No, literally I'm the older brother. And I have a sister who's 1 year older than me. And when at my father's funeral, she kept introducing me to people I didn't know as her older brother. And I had to pull her aside and say, you know, you're actually older than I am. And she said, no, I don't think so. I think I took one look at our family and ducked, and everything hit you when you showed up. And I think you're actually my older brother. So that.
We all have these different assignments. But again, to understand, in a backstage way, we go, people play many roles in the fairy realms. But I love also your going down into fear and the etymology of fear, which is fair, and you said it comes from, you know, like thoroughfare. And I thought maybe we could speak about fear, because there's so much of that available.
That's something that has interested me actually since I was young growing up. I was in a lot of scary circumstances, and I tried to understand fear, and several times it saved my life. So I knew that fear had intelligence, and then I found out that it's connected to the word fair, as in thoroughfare, and fear ultimately means the place you have to go through, and that it's fear isn't the problem, it's being paralyzed in the face of fear that's the problem. But fear, as they used to say, is the guide. And culturally, that's important right now, this argument about being in a post-truth world and all that stuff is telling us where we have to go, that this is the time to struggle and take chances to find the deeper truths of life and the deeper meanings of the soul again. It's the only answer to the confusion happening all over. And so I like to think of fear as a guide, and it's when we don't respond, either fight, flight, or whatever, if we just stay in fright, then we're stuck in fear, when fear was really trying to tell us, don't go there, or go there right now.
Right. And again, you're so good at nuance. And for somebody who wasn't sure they wanted to contribute to the world, you are among the most prolific people I know, so there's something going on there. But with huge resonance and receptivity, right? I mean, you put out these beautiful things every week, and I think you write a book about a month, you know, it seems. And so you're you know, empathic outsider with insider spiraling it in there. But many nuances of fear. A friend says fear is always in the middle ground. You know, when it's far away, we kind of blow it off. And when it's right there in your face, you work it. And that initiatory descent. And you also speak about, you know, safety and risk, which is really important. And you have the wonderful African saying, I do not trust those who have never fallen, for one day they will fall like everyone else. Yeah, it's like when people say, I've completely done with the underworld. I'm like, oh my God, run. It's going to open up any second here. You know, yeah. It's always available and always humbling in some dynamic way. But that's a theme, you know, when all the passages I was opening up to in your book, Why the World Doesn't End, Tales of Renewal and Times of Loss, and going, yeah, I've met a lot of, you know, intriguing people at medicine gatherings and other kinds of gatherings, and some of them that I really trusted, they had really rough lives, were cage fighters, and their mother abandoned them and married a con and did bad things, and now they're really kind and do good, and it's like, I love those people, right? And it's, again, this theme that I think is worthy of exploring, of redemption. I mean, Milarepa was a highwayman and a murderer, and he becomes the greatest saint in all of Tibetan Buddhism. And I'm extremely interested in redemption and that sense of kinship with the perpetrator. I have a wonderful ally, you know, a client who's a forensic psychiatrist, and her job is to maintain kinship with somebody who's done something awful. And I think that's part of our assignment, going, that could happen, and you know, and the realm of redemption, those who've really gone to a difficult place and come back, right? Not everybody makes it back. But do you have thoughts on these themes of redemption and how we can stir the cauldron that, well, I love that the word that translated to us as evil from Aramaic, and Aramaic means unripe. So
yeah.
I'm not convinced of evil beyond redemption. I don't know. These are big things, but I know you've thought about all these big things.
Well, I'm with you on that. I was raised Catholic, so I'm a recovering Catholic, and so I had to find out what redemption was outside of the idea that you're only redeemed on the other side of life. And so a lot of fairy tales turn out to be about small redemptions, which usually are like breaking spells. So I think breaking spells is another way of thinking about redemption. And of course, Milarepa is one of my heroes. I mean, he was really a serial killer, actually, in a sense, you know. And he used the powers of meditation to kill at his mother's suggestion. I mean, that's one of the wildest stories in the whole world. And then he becomes, you know, the highest saint up in the Himalayas. But there's, you know, that little redemption story between him and his sister, where he's gone for so long, and people think they can't even find him. He looks like a rock. He's covered with moss. He's so still. And then his sister hears that it might be her brother up there in a cave, and she comes. And he's been trying to break through to that last little veil into full enlightenment, and he can't do it. And then here comes his sister, and she's a goat herd. And so she offers some goat milk, and of course he only takes air and barely takes that. And he doesn't want to break his rule of his ascetic practice, and yet it's his kin and it's his sister, and she's offering something. And so against all of his practice, he drinks the milk from his sister, and boom, he breaks through into full enlightenment. And so there's even that redemption that is against our will almost, or against our understanding, or even against our practice.
Right. So. And just to kind of tease medicine from all the chaos around the world and expand our repertoire of responses, you know, the recent mass murder in Toronto where a man in a van killed people, but there was a great article in The Guardian about here's how a calm nation responds, because there was no xenophobia, there was a very famous now the policeman who the article is called the cop who wouldn't shoot, and he's cornered the killer, and the killer's like, I have a gun, kill me, I have a gun, kill me, and the cop kept saying, I don't care, put it down, there you go. And it's very powerful, you know. And again, we want to kind of brew this medicine in our collective, you know. I have a gun. I don't care. You know, it's like, well, what? I want to add that to my, ooh, that's a pretty good repertoire response, you know. And the man saying, you know, kill me. No, I won't kill you.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
So there's that redemption right in the moment, right in the world, you know, despite everything else going on, something pretty deeply ingrained in people, understanding that moment of life and death actually could tip either way, and it is up to us to some degree. That's beautiful.
So there is, I mean, there is a natural reactivity, you know, I know friends who were friends with a great woman, Ayahuasquero, who was recently murdered in Peru, and the villagers, you know, killed the man, they're pretty sure, killed her, but it's a big, interesting story, and it's like, whoa. And so we did have this conversation about, you know, evil and redemption, and what if that man that the villagers killed was innocent? And I go, and what if he was guilty? You know, and we understand the reactivity, and then common sense friends said, you know, that man was threatening the village, and policemen were nowhere available, and a village takes care of its own, and that's what you got to do, this rough justice. And I go, okay, that is one story. But I did have a deep related medicine journey in which I really descended into knowing how somebody could do a terrible thing. We go, whoa, that's how that happens. Whoa. You know, and so again, I guess it's, you know, compassion and forgiveness for all the characters in the mystery play, going, boy. You know, and these deep realms of initiation that people are traipsing around, you know, I mean, you know, these powerful medicine ceremonies of ayahuasca and different medicines that are very, very powerful, and very portals to underworld can be, not always, can be. But it's an interesting theme, and I've also met people at medicine gatherings who apparently had no conscious inner life, even though they've taken plenty of sacraments and they're big deals at Burning Man, you know, but they don't believe that, you know, protecting life matters. And, you know, I think it goes in a category of, you know, just because you go to Burning Man, just because you take a million sacraments does not necessarily mean you're not fending off wonder in some curious way. And you speak about this a lot. You write about the three kinds of people. Is there a way you might want to present that, you know, in however way you want to do that?
Well, it's an old idea that the first kind of person only thinks of themselves, and they're all about I, me, and mine. And of course, we've elected that to high office. And the second kind of person, of course, is a bit of an antidote, and saying No, it should be you and I. It should be both people win, a win-win situation, not a win-lose situation. And in a way, that's what makes culture, that people say, well, let's make it so that everybody, or at least most everybody, wins, and that's a good thing. But I started thinking about this when years ago when I watched how someone says, oh, maybe we'll go to war in Iran, and people go, no, not a good idea. But then they declare, we're going to war in Iran, and suddenly it's 80% of the people are in favor of the war, the exact ones who weren't in favor until it was declared. And so that made me realize that the win-win people collapse under pressure. And so then there's a third category of people who have already been to the underworld. They've already been in exile. They've already gone through the suffering. And they've already been in despair. And when their vision comes back and they are redeemed, let's say, then you cannot move them out of the place where they have found, no matter how much pressure you bring. The third kind of person, I think we're calling the outsider, we're calling it the visionary, and we're calling it the person who has the root of self going down so deeply that they cannot simply be out for me and mine, but they also can't be chased out of win-win. They're the ones that you can count on when the chips are down, when something is needed. They're the ones that can be sacrificial. They're the ones that can perhaps even offer a blessing. And they're the ones that can keep finding the vision.
No, I think this is really crucial to now. And again, the invitation and the availability to, and even speaking of it, to be that deeper part. The first people, you know, I've got mine, I think of, you know, Hinayana Honky in a hot tub, and many different forms of it going, I've got mine. But this theme of slippage, right, exactly. I remember when the first Gulf War broke out, I was invited to an artist gathering, and I presumed it was to see what we could do to stop it. But it's true, as you say, people were mouthing platitudes going, well, there was no other choice, and at least the bombs are smart. I'm like,
no.
I go, you're artists. Artists always have, you know, all war is a failure of imagination, whatever. But I was a little strident, right? So people, it was not well met. People were like, oh, who do you think you are? And a wonderful friend of mine later said, you know, to spiral out of polarity, people never mind being asked, did you know? Did you know the Kuwaitis were slant drilling oil? Did you know? Did you know? You know, because it, as unless we're asking it with attitude, but if we compost our hermphitude, did you know, people go, oh, no, I didn't know that. And so I think to be full of our magic backpacks, did you know material, and then that theme of collapsing under pressure, and then the root of self, and that's why I'm so interested in the literal and the symbolic realm of, you know, Paul Stamets talking about, you know, the studies ancient and modern of psilocybe mushrooms, that they calm down the amygdala, right, which is the reactive fear portion of the brain, increase cooperation among the other regions of the brain, and increase confidence and kindness. And Stamets was saying those are leadership qualities, right? Confidence and kindness.
So even just a
metaphoric wafting to everybody, a little micro radio dose of psilocybe. You know, just going, everybody calm down, our rogue species, just calm the amygdala down there, confidence and kindness. And I love, in one of the very few Aikido lessons I've taken, but I aspire to go back, the Aikido teacher said, yeah, the more competent you are, the more you can have compassion. You know, if you're skilled, you know, if something's coming at you and you go, no, don't do that, and you take it down, you go, don't do that, you'll hurt yourself, right? It allows for a kind of wit and compassion, and I love that. And then I've often said, you know, the trickster path, to which I'm really in love and dedicated, you know, no rules but guidelines. And sometimes people say, well, what does that mean? And then the next Aikido class, they go, don't resist, guide everything. Swoosh. What does this want to be? What did this want to be before it got all, you know, orthodoxed and snookered, you know, and where does it really want to go? And, you know, so that everything, you know, because I so love the trickster model of the hero, Scheherazade, Haijan the Conqueror in the South, who's willing to liberate the land and the humans and not counting on, but willing to liberate even the tyrant who has hardened their heart. And now we're back to redemption. But we don't count on it. And Trump is the hardest cartoon of sociopathic dingbattery of all, because it's like, oh, you just want to, it's hard to imagine just, you know, how do you dance with Trump as an embodiment? I mean, of course, it's going to be more serious when he goes, because it's whatever gave rise to him that we must
decide. Yeah, he's the symptom. I think of him as the symptom, and almost like the case study to understand what's going on in the American psyche. Now, you know, it's helpful to know that there are these strong men types, and who are usually narcissists and usually lack empathy, all over the world, in the Philippines and in parts of Europe and other places. And so that it's something that has arisen as a symptom of the current situation. The current situation, I think, being collapsed discovery. And so,
Hold that thought, collapsed discovery, because I was so mesmerized that we blew right past our mid-show short break. Our wonderful guest is Michael Mead. His website is mosaicvoices.org, and we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Ooh, chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make his voyage long.
Down. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our splendiferous mytho ally guide, Michael Mead, is our guest this hour. So, yes, so you had a phrase, you had two words right before we went to the short break. Do you remember what those were?
Collapse and discovery.
Thank you. Yes, wherever you want to go with collapse and discovery, right.
Well, this goes back to that book, Why the World Doesn't End, which begins with a kind of description of the original word apocalypse, the Greek word, which became, you know, anglicized as apocalypse. And of course, it means not the end of the world. It means the lifting of the veil, first of all. And now you see into the lawyers' offices in New York City. You see into all the dirty deals in the back deal, including the tax laws and everything like that. You see that, the lifting of the veil. But it also means a period of collapse and renewal. That it is the end in a certain sense, but it's the end beginning, or as it ends, it begins. And as a matter of fact, the word end doesn't mean finito, goodbye, over and out. It means loose end or tail end. And so at the end is a tail end from which the tail starts again. And so that's the period I think we're in. And so in a way, Trump is a symbol, or even, you know, like an idol of this ending, of this kind of deep, deep emptiness that has to swallow everything, even the truth, even the lies, whatever, and the insatiable emptiness of the person who has lost their soul, in a sense. And so I think it points to the rest of us needing to find our soul, and also I think it points to us having a choice. If it is the collapse and falling apart of things, but also the renewal of things, then we're standing in that kairos, as the Greeks called it, and we're standing in that moment of when even the gods change, as Jung said, and our choice is to contribute to the recreation, despite your sister, to contribute to the recreation, or get pulled into the collapse and miss the opportunity to be a maker in the times when things are trying to be remade.
Right. Well, you begin Why the World Doesn't End, you know, with a perfect for now. Jupiter storytelling is retrograde, meaning deep diving in Scorpio, right on your midheaven, which is my midheaven too. As we delve in, you write, the end lies concealed in the beginning, but the opposite is also true. The beginning is hidden in all that comes to an end. That's part of our kind of astral myth guiding, you know, for everyone now, deep delving all the different chapters of each person's life and then our own collective life to retrieve what we need now and to bring it alive and fresh conversing as a guide. The problem, of course, the dynamic with our rogue species is we're taking so much life, you know, with us. So my encouragement, the cooperators who are standing by, is that, you know, it wants to be a return, this kind of Uranus trickster in Taurus, of humans humbly cooperating with nature's guiding genius, the work of biomimicry and Janine Benyus and, you know, and democratic animism and, you know, these important parts of being human that we got shamed out of, going, oh, you know, including the progressive left-wing team, you know, going, oh, we'll listen to it from Native Americans because, or whatever, but, you know, but, no, it's like, again, cooperating with everything in some way and, you know, that Trump is the well, I like the metaphor of, you know, possession, not to get all spooked out by it, but just that idea that he is possessed by a cunning demonic retrovirus, and that you can see it when it leaves him, like when he goes down at the end of every sentence, and we must fight for, and he goes all kind of empty, and then it'll gleam through him, right? And that's when I you know, and I want to pitch it back to you, because, you know, when I knew this was going to happen, when I stepped out of the Republican convention that I went to, I was like, oh no, you know, he's we're getting smoked on our strong suit of storycraft, right? And
yeah.
I love craft. You know, craft means power from dedication, and, you know, he's the toxic mimic of all of that, you know, multi-level marketing, and I will give you the razzle-dazzle con man, I will bring to you the, you know, the greatest change you've ever wanted, whatever, and I did, I sank to my knees going, oh, come on, team storycraft, you know, for everyone, here's the outsider again, for everyone to co-craft with nature's guiding genius the irresistible magnetizing story of Renaissance that invites the best of everybody. Come on, we need you. Come on, we need you to do this beautiful thing. And I think that's the great moment now to compost our righteousness and, you know, and anything that is like a finger-wagging polarity and going, no, come on over here. You know, because I do love James Karst writing about the Renaissance was not defined as against. It was an irresistible magnetizing invitation of the best of humans. Come on over here. Come on over here. So, because that's part of what you're up to, really, right?
Yeah, and operating on the idea that it all is slightly tipped towards creation, that you hit those, you know, they talk about tipping points. We're in an almost mythological tipping point where it seems like it all could go, you know, straight downhill into the underworld. But there's always that little bit which humans, I think, are supposed to contribute to, that life is slightly tipped towards ongoing creation. And so now that the mistake has been made, and, you know, watching, I grew up in New York, so I watched Trump while I was growing up. And, of course, everyone in New York knows his history as a con man and a complete flim-flam character. And so it's amazing that he rose to this place. But in a sense, he rose there by saying success is gathering money, having a trophy wife, and we've lost what America was about, which was really white people being on top. And he pulled that off. It was a great, you know, kind of sleight of hand in a funny way. But I don't think the hand plays all the way out. I think that the hollowness catches up. And so I think we should be ready to imagine what happens next, and which is also happening now. And I guess I go back to the word imagine and the old idea that imagination is the deepest power of the soul, and it is really the force of redemption. And so I think part of what's been happening before Trump got into his ascendancy was a complete in political life anyway.
Wait, hello? You cut out on one crucial word. One before he got to his ascendancy, it was a complete what of political life?
There's a funny sound, I think, that cut it out. I don't know what I said.
Well, it's there in the recording somewhere. All right, we'll find that thing. right. But I love also the fairy tale that you elaborate. You know, be thankful for the trouble you find in this world, the old people would say. Be thankful for the black dog that occasionally unravels the whole thing. Right? So it's unraveling, you know. They knew that the dog is black in order to remind people that this world must be repeatedly rewoven from darkness as well as light. And I think that's also, you know, that there is no one way to be or to contribute, you know, people in their cave, you know, spiraling blessings out into the world. Perfect, you know, as much equal as anybody's destiny as, you know, street action and all that. But there's a lot to cahoot with. You know, and that's why I love gathering these medicines, the cop who wouldn't shoot, you know, kill me, I have a gun, I don't care. I so love that. The rise of the Parkland youth, you know, and, you know, all part of this renaissance of inclusivity and sanity, and so skillful at spiraling out of polarity when the, you know, mainstream news tries to put them in a box, even the allegedly liberal one, you know, aren't you mad about this? And they're like, no, we want to concentrate on the shared vision of this is where we're going. They're pretty great. And I loved, thinking a lot of those, high school seniors, they're turning 18 this year, so they were born in 2000, right? They're dragons. In 2000 was the Saturn-Jupiter conjunction in Taurus, so it's like sane, reverent common sense, you know, kind of coming up. And for everything toxic, there's a tonic, so it's like that's a positive sleeper cell. Just like everybody who lived through the 60s or who was born in the 60s is kind of like a positive sleeper cell, kind of waking up going, wait a minute, things are really important. And that's why the invitation, you know, for all of us, it's so important. Come on over here, you know, here's this, which is kind of the essence of initiation of teens and veterans and everything. We need you. You know, we, you know, and crooks and, you know, redemptive in the underworld people going, what a lot of creativity you have to do all this evil. Let's liberate, boy, could we use you over here, you know, and your underworld skills as well. Come on over, whistleblowers and former whatever the thing is. But it does require us composting. Well, it requires cultivating complexity, that there are many parts of people, and everyone's befoibled, right? And everyone's been to the underworld, or they're going there, you know, and some people have done bad things, but we want to speak to the good part of them as well, going, come on over, right? So more tolerance, yeah?
Yeah, and many people have lost a loved one and gone to the underworld that way, or they've gotten a serious illness and gone that way. And I think it's not clear enough to many people that all of those losses and all of those descents are underworld initiations, and whatever a person finds that brings them back to life is in fact proof of their ability to contribute to life and its renewal. So it's really, as you said way at the beginning, when the descent begins, don't fight it, dive, because at the bottom there isn't emptiness. At bottom, there's the uniqueness of one's soul. And I think we all came here to contribute to the beauty of things and to the ongoing energies of creation. And we just happen to have come at a time when it's needed from everybody in order to counterbalance what's happening in the toxic areas that have developed culturally.
Right. And so Renaissance, of course, is who brought what? You know, and I love when you're writing also about, you know, destiny, that we're born with an imprint and everyone's got a sense of mission. It might have gone to sleep, you know, but again, that we need you to stir that and waken it. And I love, you know, I increasingly love the astrological language and craft. You know, I started studying in 1970 and I learn from it every day, and I trust it more than I trust even myself. Or maybe quite a lot more, because, you know, everything's in a frame, right? So when I said the underworld's been kicking my butt lately, going into deep places, but then, of course, we magnetize, you know, our inner life magnetizes outer opportunity, working with a lot of people who really have, you know, they have tough assignments, you know, their narrative. And I do love being able to say, you know, as humans, we go, oh my goodness, to hear your narrative story of descent and difficulty and death and pain and so much, you know. You know, so as humans, we go, oh dear, but as symbolists and astrologers, we go, good for you, you're right on schedule. We'd be worried if you weren't, you know, because it is true. And then it does proffer these guides of, well, how do we cooperate with this big mystery? We don't presume to impose certainty on mystery, and you're really good at this on mystery and the whole concept of time, And I love, again, you know, you have a chapter stopping in time, which is great because, you know, and you wrote this book, I guess, 2012, before the great spiritual colonialism of the hoovering up of the Mayan calendar and some good things, too. But, you know, the Aztecs, their model is each world is born of and will die of its creative element. And they're gloomier than the Mayans, you know. But they said, yeah, the world that we're in is born of and will die of busyness, right? Motion.
Of what?
Busyness.
Hmm.
It is born of and it will die of being busy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
But because you have a great, you know, part of the stopping in time, the teacher, the person ardent in their desire for enlightenment, again, we might say Hinayanahanki, you know, and the teacher says, how do you know that what you seek is running somewhere before you so that you must spend all your energy rushing after it? What if what you most need is actually behind you, trying to catch up to you? What if the knowledge and wisdom you seek is waiting for you to descend to it? What if all your haste and feverish determination turn out to be your own habitual pattern of running away from what's been trying to catch up to you all along? That's really useful.
Yeah, that's helpful. And in the Renaissance, amidst all that change, they had that festina lente was the bumper sticker, which meant make haste slowly. And I think whenever they're saying slowly or descent, they're talking about the soul. I mean, spirit likes to take off and go for the big ride and for the high peak, but soul likes to descend and get deeper and get rooted. And so I think typically now in the modern world, it's soul that's missing. And anything we can do that makes soul keeps everybody more connected and makes it more possible to bring deep connectivity back and to bring the deep roots of imagination back. So I think we're in one of those times of making soul in the midst of disaster, which I think is a fine human activity.
Well, and that's where, I mean, anima, soul, and to animate something is to honor its soul. And now I'm back to my favorite practice, really, is animism. Because I did live with a coyote, an actual coyote, longer than I've lived with a human, 19 years. And so it's kind of like a fairy tale. I don't look at it with, just, I look at it more with like, huh, look at that. But I have learned a lot. And I love heaving humanism into the cauldron, going, humans is the measure of all things. And it's like, what about the wolves and the coyotes and the you know, kingfisher birds and the everything? You know, and so I'm viewing, you know, this respect. One of my favorite Abe Lincoln quotes is he said, I care not for any man's religion whose dog and cat are not the better for it. I go, go, Abe. I think that's a useful criterion. Sorry, say what?
Yeah, and the animals, of course, in the fairy tales are often the ones that bring the redemption. And
right.
So, yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, of course, we have to somehow solve this error in which people forgot that human nature is automatically connected to great nature, and that means the trees and the plants as well as the animals. And that's all part of, you know, remaking the soul connections, which I think we've been invited to do.
I mean, I think so, and I think the assignment is to look at every quirky part of us, every affinity, you know, the love of a culture or an animal or a plant, flora, fauna. And I do think of, you know, Neptune in Pisces now, you know, making all myths and fairy tales available for fresh animation, as though the, you know, flora, fauna meeting backstage going, what are we going to do about the humans? We got to either kill them or heal them. Oh, we'll try both, but we'll try healing them first by let's make everything that has ever moved them to pragmatic mysticism, to conscious kinship available for fresh expression. Here's part of your weird, your destiny that you're fulfilling. You know, every piece of myth or fairy tale or poetry or music that has ever been good for humans, let's bring that back. And I think, you know, experimental partnering, you know, whatever we love, we are its agent in the court of the, you know, human empire in some way, you know, and so I've been sort of, we all have our different assignments, you know, and it's not to derive status from, you know, alleged power animals. It's just like, you know, entering into a conversation, right? Con, with, verse, turning. We're all in a giant conversation. And I love that, right now Chiron, a little planetoid that really does exist, and people say the wounded healer, and that's really the boring part, because Chiron's the first mentor. He's a, a centaur mentor. And Chiron has just emerged from Pisces into Aries. And I overheard a wonderful woman banjo player saying, thank goodness for limitations, otherwise we would be in a world of, limitless possibilities. And so it's the theme of mentoring, because he's not only a mentor, a centaur mentor, and he teaches Asclepius and Orpheus and many important beings, but he goes on a journey and founds the Asclepions, the cultural centers that really existed of intentional dreaming, healing, and theater.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that wants to come alive. It's alive. It's like, the mentoring. I mean, you are mentor, and you've had mentors, right?
Yes, fortunately, yes.
I mean, do you have mentors that you come to mind now that you'd like to go thank you?
Oh, a big thanks to James Hillman, who I know you also love,
yeah.
and Robert Bly was a big mentor to me. But, here's a strange thing. I was mentored by a lot of people that weren't alive at the same time as me. I found out that, the old poets and the storytellers, I mean, Scheherazade that you mentioned is a mentor to me, just sitting with her story, but her idea, her embodied idea, that you could be willing to sacrifice your life for another person because you knew that having a story meant that the whole world could change and you could survive by virtue of story. That mentored me. That made me realize the value and importance of story, since I was kind of stuck with this Irish gift of gab. And so I found that maybe just extending the idea that the mentors are the animals and the eagles that show up when you need a new idea, but they're also the plants, and then they're the invisibles of all kinds, and then they're the ancestors, especially the ones that have made some kind of a path in the world that's similar to the one we might be called to. So, yeah, I've had lots of mentors, continue to have them.
Right, and well, Scheherazade, yeah, so we're both recovering Catholics, Irish people who both have 25 Capricorn rising in the same midheaven, and you're a Moon-Neptune conjunction, and I'm a Sun-Neptune conjunction in Libra, so splendid, we're in parallel or interweaving DNA strands. That's really great, but there's a wonderful, wonderful movie, I don't know if you've seen it, of the Arabian Nights. It's available on YouTube in a 2-hour version. There's a 6-hour version, but they play it in a pretty great way, because the first time she volunteers, right, to marry the sociopathic king who's murderous, who's hardened his heart, even though she doesn't have to, and she goes, no, watch this, it's a trick. But the way they do it is she almost blows it on the first night. She almost can't quite, she almost dies. Then she goes to consult with the storyteller in the marketplace, played by great Alan Bates, who says, when my audience doesn't like my story, they leave. When your audience doesn't like your story, you die. And he teaches her story craft, and it's very wonderfully played, and great telling of Alibaba, and great aesthetically fantastic thing. And what they do also is a genius thing, which is, it's pretty much intrinsic to the Arabian Nights, but by the end, where Shahryar calls her his redeemer, you have saved me from my sociopathic, I mean, he doesn't use that psycho term, but you have saved me from my murderous heart. And she gets, when they get truly married, right, she's wearing a dress embroidered with all of the animals and plants, so the king must wed the earth, and which is also like the Grail legend and Dame Ragnall, the king must wed the earth in a beautiful way. But then great evil, and maybe this is part of our dynamic here, great evil enters the world, Shahryar's evil brother is going to take over, and he uses something practical from every story she's told him to save the world. I mean, practical stuff like hiding in jars and things, I mean, or I mean, all of that, and we go, yes, that this time now of all the lore that you have and that you bring alive through fresh telling and all that each one of our dedicated listeners out there that we have, it's like let's wonder how we might tease this into practicality with with jaunty aplomb.
I think of it as applied mythology.
Right. Yes, exactly. Pragmatic mysticism, applied divination, and practical mythology. Because that's the incarnational sensuality going, okay, well, because it's happening anyway. I mean, I think that's part of the Trump thing, is that, you know, the demonic has entered into the world. It's all very literal now, you know, and that's why being able to read things symbolically is so crucial. It's like the backstage gods are like, he looks like the devil. Do we have to make it more simple for you humans? You know, how much more literal do we have to make it? I think that idea of, you know, mythological literacy, and the restoration of mythological literacy. And one of the things, you know, that we love about Hillman and we got to speak of, I did send you the radio show I did with him. I don't know if you got it.
Yeah, I listened. It was great.
It was good. That was good. I mean, because in keeping with our, in contrast to our first conversing, you know, where we thought he was kind of afraid of ritual and there was that part of him, but he was pretty darn playful there. What we spoke of, you know, cultivating intimacy with the power of symbols and story grants strategic social advantage. And he was like, yeah, right.
Yeah, so he definitely, he was also the bringing the banner of soul into the world of psychology and, you know, scientific thought about human psyche and so on. And so he was a crusader in a certain sense that way. And just blessed me, which I'm grateful for always.
Right. And we received the baton, you know, the Yoruba, you know, the ancestors have sent us to receive and complete their work, right?
And that, and part of going down is to touch that ancestral ground, because it's not just behind, it's also below us, and it's available for taprooting into.
No, cooperators are standing by and standing under. That's really great. So wonderful to conversationally deeply delve with yourself, Michael Mead. Thank you so much for your work and this show. Again, mosaicvoices.org. And you probably have events coming up that we forgot to tout, but people can go to your website and find them, right?
They can find them right on the website, yeah.
Excellent. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, and thanks always to Erica Bridgman, and I'm Caroline Casey, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Many ways to play. Woof woof. Thanks so much.